On the northwest corner of Pine and Sacramento Streets in Redding, California, sits a rather nondescript structure that now functions as something that is known as Umpqua Bank. In 1909, however, it was a large two- and three-story building with porches and breezeways between wings, wings that belonged to the St. Caroline's Hospital. On July 3rd of 1909, the hospital would be treated to a flurry of action and information as a out-of-towner would be brought in with horrific burns on his face and almost all of his body, to a point that bringing him here was more of an academic exercise than any medicinal remediation. What they didn't realize, though, was the origin of his injuries. An airship disaster, one that would precede the Hindenburg by nearly 28 years, and Captain James Moore would now be left to the ages. Let's take a look back at that fateful day in 1909 from box number 7. Recreation Park was once the central gathering point for rallies, ball games, and especially the newly resumed annual 4th of July celebrations in Redding, California. This year, 1909, was no different, and the air was thick with excitement as Captain James Moore was preparing his aptly named Airship America to make the first of three contracted flights over the city. Making his own gas by a seemingly alchemical combination of 3 tons of sulfuric acid, 300 pounds of iron shavings, and 6,000 gallons of water, Moore used a set of tanks that came with him on the train to produce his own animating gas. Moore displayed a keen sense of adventure, individualism, and rugged resolve when discussing his previous 200 flights in the June 22nd edition of the Shasta Courier. And in that interview, he discussed the rogue nature of what he did, proclaimed that he'd rather fly than drive, and even talked about being shot at one time during a midair in a showcase in Tennessee by some disgruntled crank. That is to say, the man had been around the block. And though he admitted that few people ever really had the nerve to ask to join him at an ultimate 600-foot elevation above their town, he was also reticent to proclaim airship travel as some burgeoning option for the future, citing the lack of innovations, especially in the production of gas. Quote, "I look for some very serious accidents if aviators continue as they are at present," unquote. He had no idea that he would be the fulfillment of his own prophecy in 11 short days. As people gathered at Recreation Park, which is now the current site of Redding's own YMCA, Moore went through the usual processes and workflows of filling the Japanese-made silk bag, described as cigar-shaped, that would contain the gas. What no one was aware of, however, was the untested rigging and framework. It was untested, and Moore made all his own geometric assumptions about its feasibility. At least that is what is assumed, with so many gaps in the informational pipeline here. There was an hour delay in getting the ship primed, but it wasn't procedural hang-ups or really anything that would have raised a concern. And on the ground was the pilot's half-brother, A.M. Short, to provide all known navigational assistance and possibly you know, cryptic dialogue between aeronautic types. As Moore ascended at a 45-degree angle and began to climb, people near the ship noticed the propeller in front cutting into the bag, making a divot and slowly starting to pierce the epidermal outside. Short yelled out to Moore to let him know what was going on. Now, whether Moore understood what was happening, Moore was engaged in his own issue here as he ascended across the cage to counterweight what was the 45-degree cant, normally using sandbags, but apparently sandbags were in shortage, so Moore was going to counterweight the ship by putting his own weight on the other end of the framework. And somehow, within this process, is where a spark ignited from the motor and lit the bag on fire. The disaster was instant, violent, and palpable to the entire crowd. Reports say he was 25 feet above the ground, although some estimate it to be 40 or even 50 feet. The photograph captured mid-disaster makes the latter part seem a lot more correct, possibly 40 feet. But either way, Moore came falling to Earth with burns from the initial explosion, as well as subsequent injuries from the fall. The burning bag unfortunately landed squarely on top of Moore. Short ran to the wreckage with the help of two or three others, pulled Moore from the wreckage, and not without injury. Short himself would be treated for severe burns on his left hand and arm, and especially possible third-degree burns on three of his fingers. S.H. Fisk, another individual, also burnt his hands pulling the burning silk off of Moore. Others suffered contusions, burn impact shocks, and even singed hair and eyebrows from the initial blast. As doctors Sailor, Stable, White, and Edgecombe took charge of Moore, describing his burns as having his entire first layer of skin burned away on over two-thirds of his body. He also had a fractured pelvis, broken wrist, and a broken femur. His head was completely burned. Moore would awaken intermittently and talk to his half-brother, and he was also supposed to have proclaimed to someone on the ground at the wreck site that his lungs were, quote, not full of gas, unquote. Though cryptic, none of it mattered in practical terms because the medical staff provided no hope. And despite working on Moore for 4 hours, at 11:45 in the evening on July 3rd, Moore was gone. He would be taken to Houston's Undertaker Shop in North Reading and readied for burial. Also present, though, at St. Caroline's Hospital was 78-year-old carpenter Milton Mygatt, who suffered a broken hip at the hands of a frantic mob that ran straight away over him. News reports of conflicting origin placed his recovery between the probable and the unlikely. Ultimately, the newsprint narrative wrote off the old guy as dead in the water. In fact, conflicting media accounts would briefly pester this entire story. The July 9th edition of The Searchlight ran a mid-page headline saying, quote, "Aeronaut Moore is still alive," and that one reads as follows. An inquest over the remains of James Locke Canfield, the aviator who was making assumptions under the assumed name of James Moore and who was fatally injured in his airship last Saturday, was held yesterday at the Reading Undertaking Parlors. A verdict of accidental death was brought in by the coroner's jury. The fact was brought out in the examination of witnesses that Mr. Canfield blamed no one for the disaster and said, previous to his death, that a sudden gust of wind striking the ship alone was the cause of the mishap. So the newspaper basically says that the assistant to James Moore was using his name flying the ship and laid no blame on anything structural, but it was an act of God. They were, however, scooped by the Courier Free Press 2 days earlier, and if the Searchlight would have paid attention, they would have realized that the Courier Free Press actually spoke with Caulfield's wife and found out that he was using the assumed name, like a stage name, of James Moore, sort of like the entertainment equivalent of Reginald Kenneth Dwight actually being Elton John, or should we say Elton John is actually Reginald Kenneth Dwight. And it was the Courier Free Press that actually had the interview with the captain prior to his appearance in Reading back in June. So they already had an established media contact. The Searchlight had no such contacts. At least it doesn't appear that was the case at the time. So they got it wrong. And I'm just going to say something that, in short, technology and the modern era has done nothing to solve this kind of thing. Even worse, though, the Record Searchlight would double down on their own faulty information in a 4th of July recap in the July 1st, 1977 edition, and continues to erroneously refer to his surname as Canfield instead of Caulfield, and still continues to claim that it was journalistic erroneousness that said that James Moore was killed instead of his assistant. So even in 1977, Record Searchlight, you were getting it wrong. And by the way, Milton Mygatt, the 78-year-old man that was left for dead in terms of journalistic presumptuousness, would not succumb to his injuries, or as he say in A Christmas Carol, Tiny Tim, who did not die, he would live another 5 years. And in fact, Mygatt's constitution was so tough, so inexplicably Teflon, that in 1911, a bumpy ambulance ride to apparently deal with ruptured intestines managed to bump his intestines back into place, so that when he arrived, Dr. Stable then proclaimed that he was no longer in need of the surgery that had been prognosticated. Apparently, the ride to the hospital was so bumpy, that it actually cured a weird intestinal foul-up in what at the time would have been, an 81-year-old man. Anyway, Mygatt walked away and said, peace out. Okay, he didn't actually say that. He wouldn't have said that anyway. He spent a few days in the hospital, but come on. I looked up, and in the newsprint, they refer to him as a very old and aged man. But I found out historically he had been a deputy sheriff. He, in his 70s, he was on search and rescue, going to retrieve bodies, and he actually was a deputy coroner at one point or another. Absolutely insane that none of that is mentioned when he got run over by a throng in 1909 and had his hip broken. Absolutely insane. I wish I could have known this guy. And I have no idea what that man was made of, but the company that makes black boxes for the FAA called me and asked me to take them to the grave so they could exhume his body for extractionary purposes. Just kidding. Mygatt passed away in his sleep in 1915, and I'm going to guess on his own terms. Caulfield, the pilot, is buried at Reading Cemetery in the southeast corner. The Reading Sundial Bridge is notably visible from that spot. But no real indication of why he was laid there, however. It would seem that the confusion over his identity possibly managed to mute the exploratory nature of the research. Ultimately, he was buried there, and his wife would be granted a life insurance return of I believe, $2,500, and move on with her life. I believe she married again and lost another husband in a subsequent mining accident, and then possibly married for a third time. I don't have really the paper on her right now. But Caulfield was buried alone, away from his home, and in an individual plot with sort of a vagabond's disconnected reference point, really. The headstone is beautiful, but it has certainly no real connection to the town in which he died, other than the headlines of 116 years ago and the 2,000 souls that watched Icarus fall to Earth on July 3rd of 1909. And this is box number 7.